Good morning, everyone. Okay, so I hope that after this talk, you are all enthusiastic about biblical miracles as I am. So let's delve right into it. What is the point of biblical miracles? Are they fiction or are they fact? Why study them at all? These are just some of the questions many ask while trying to unravel the enigma of biblical miracles. Without a doubt, unraveling such an issue is challenging because, as biblical scholars are known to do, every aspect is controversial. From their historical validity to their theological value, there is little agreement between biblical scholars on the importance of miracles. While this does not mean that our task is impossible, it does require some prudence to move safely through the minefield of scholarship, so as to avoid the extremes, such as naively accepting everything that is written in the Bible as fact, and also removing all biblical miracles from the Bible itself, as, for instance, Thomas Jefferson did. I think that what causes all this difference of opinions is the fact that many scholars study miracles decontextualized, as if they occur in a vacuum. And yet we cannot forget that miracles do not happen in isolation, but rather within the great context of creation and the history of salvation. Therefore, biblical miracles need to be examined from within the larger narrative that assumes that nature and natural phenomenon within it have but one author, the omnipotent Creator God who has created creation in order to have shalom with it. In fact, I will make two claims in this presentation. The first claim is that the theological objective of miracles in the Bible is to either bring about human flourishing, which are those miracles which restore creation, or to externalize and accentuate a human withering already present, miracles that undo creation, with the hope that such actions elicit a return to flourishing. This does not mean that biblical miracles can be considered as entirely ahistorical or without any basis in reality. For if the Judeo-Christian faith is based in history, then at least the more significant narratives that contain miracles need also to be grounded in reality. Of course, in order to explain if a miracle actually happened, one would need to explore how biblical authors are able to correctly label such acts as coming from God. For this reason, the second claim of this presentation is that to fully understand biblical miracles, we need to delve into issues like agency and perception, in order to not only appreciate how God as a divine agent works through nature rather than outside it, but also how humanity to perceive such actions require a simple heart. To prove these two claims, I first must define biblical miracles from within their framework of shalom. Secondly, I will offer the cycle of signs and wonders in Egypt as a good example of a series of miracles that undo creation. And then the exorcisms of Jesus as prime examples of miracles of restoration. At the same time, I will also attempt to tackle issues of how God intervenes in creation, as well as how we, as creatures, are able to perceive such acts as miracles performed by God. It's ambitious. Okay, as we have said, our first task is to define biblical miracles. And as I've just said, this is very ambitious because neither the Old nor the New Testament contains anything that could be characterized such as a definition of a miracle. Due to this lacuna, scholars often turn to modern definitions, such as that of David Hume, who defined a miracle as a violation of laws of nature. As we are all children of the Enlightenment, it's not surprising that such a definition has effectively governed the narrative ever since. But it's not without reason, right? Because it seems, on the surface of things, this is exactly what we find. from the signs and wonders in Egypt to also even the resurrection of Jesus himself. Miracles in the Bible seem to contravene the way the world works. And yet, it is also true that any such fixed notion of natural law is problematic, not only because the very nature of natural law is so debatable, but also because since we simply do not know enough of how the world works, there could be also some unexplained force at play. There are other authors who have pointed out that a biblical miracle cannot be a transgression of natural law because all of creation is under God's control. Therefore, as Eric Eve says, miracles are therefore anomalies. Other authors say that miracles seem to be an extraordinary and welcome event that's not explicable by known human capabilities or other ordinary forces, and is therefore attributed to a divine agency. Due to all of this ambiguity, what constitutes a biblical miracle, some scholars opt to not to go the modern way, but to look at biblical words, what we find in the Bible, right? Such as mighty deeds or signs and wonders. In a way, such an avenue of study can indeed be helpful, because I myself agree that miracles in the Bible are indeed signs and wonders, extraordinary actions that elicit awe and occur to endanger responsiveness from those who experience them. And yet, taken on their own, phrases such as mighty deeds or signs and wonders are not enough to explain the essence of miracles, because such phrases can be used to cover things not usually covered by miracles, like speeches and also dreams. Faced with such an impasse, many abandon the quest to define miracles. And yet, as I have already stated, I think that the main issue behind all of these different definitions is that they do not take into consideration the larger biblical context and narrative. They pluck miracles out of their context and try to discuss them on their own. So after mapping this impasse, I will now attempt to find a way out of the labyrinth, so to speak, to better explain the essence of biblical miracles by precisely placing them back in the context which they are found. And I think that the emblematic case, the simple case, is this case of Exodus 15, 22 to 26, which is the episode at Mara. This pericope, I won't read it, but you have it there on the PowerPoint. This pericope finds the people at Mara after a three-day journey from the Red Sea, with no drinking water in sight. Upon arriving, the people notice that they only find undrinkable bitter water and grumble against Moses because of it. For his part, then Moses goes to God and asks him to intercede on his behalf. God, on his part, then commands Moses to throw a piece of wood in the water and restores that bitter water into drinkable sweet water. While we, following the likes of Philo of Alexandria, who states that that piece of wood had something within it, in the nature of the wood itself, that when thrown into the water made it sweet, we could search for a rationalistic reason why throwing a piece of wood in bitter water would turn it sweet. It is nonetheless miraculous, because the primary agent who causes the change is God himself. And the act itself is to be considered as a reversal of the signs and wonders in Egypt. It is not coincidental, in fact, that this short pericope concludes with a conditional clause that God sets on the people. If you will truly listen to the voice of the Lord your God and do that which is right in his eyes and listen to his commandments and keep all of his statutes, I will not place on you any of the diseases which I placed on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Such a text squarely then places the miracle within the larger context of covenant between God and Israel, wherein Israel is called to acknowledge God as their God, and God acknowledges Israel as his people, What's interesting to me is that we have two things happening. On the one hand, we have a contrast between what God does in Egypt and that Israel is spared. But more importantly, in sparing Israel, God is called Israel's healer. Such a self-identification of God is based upon the concept of healing in the Bible, which is fundamentally concerned with how God is the creator of life and the giver of health and well-being. However, health and well-being is not just simply physical, but perhaps even more importantly, relationally healthy. What I mean here is that in the biblical world, there is a symbiotic relationship between the ethical and the cosmic order of life, which implies that right relations in society is dependent on whether we live life in accordance with the will of the Lord. In light of the remark of the signs and wonders in Egypt, considered here as diseases, it is to be recalled that the fundamental issue in Egypt was with how Pharaoh's oppressive measures against Israel are viewed as anti-life and anti-creation. Since Pharaoh went against the ethical order of life, the cosmic order becomes warped and ended up turned upside down. At the same time, the restoration of bitter water into sweet highlights God's generous positive capacity for restoration. This restoration, in contrast to the diseases in Egypt, is really an invitation for Israel to stay within the rhythmic boundaries which God has set for them. Right? So this episode of Mara is paradigmatic for me because it explains that when you don't follow the will of the Lord, then the cosmic order becomes upended. And the idea that you have the restoration, which hints at relationship. So undoing and restoring. And this is why I think that this short episode is so important. The essence of all of this discussion, I think, can be neatly encapsulated in the Hebrew word shalom, which we often translate it as peace, but it's much more than that. In reality, shalom is to be considered as the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight. Therefore, it refers to universal flourishing, which would include things like wholeness, integrity, and right relations between God, humanity, and the rest of creation. In other terms, the point of miracles would be for humanity to appreciate its creatureliness, and not only understand it must remain within the boundaries set by God, but also called to flourish under God. In this way, I think Meyer is correct that he draws attention to the fact that miracles happen within the context of interpersonal relationships, be it those that restore creation, like healings, be it those that undo creation, like the signs and wonders in Egypt. All miracles in the Bible occur either within a relationship of trust or with the aim of establishing such a kind of relationship. Therefore, I think Meyer is also correct in his claim that miracles are vehicles of encounter. For if the signs and wonder in Egypt happen in part so that the Egyptians know that I am the Lord, then even these miracles are moments when creation encounters the omnipotent creator, redeemer, God, in the hope that relationship is either healed or established. And so, what do I think is a better definition of a miracle? I think that a miracle is an extraordinary event which comes about from a special act of God, often mediated through either non-human creation or those who act on God's behalf, that aims to enact shalom. Such actions accomplish this by restoring creation, thereby establishing relationship, or by undoing creation so as to externalize human withering and instigate conversion and return. The advantage of such a definition is that it appreciates that miracles are indeed non-ordinary events that can occur through either direct or indirect divine agency with the specific aim of restoring relationships or externalizing the rupture of that relationship. But both have the scope to bring about human flourishing and the state of shalom. It also stands to reason that while it is certainly true that the Bible does not recount everything in the way that actually happened, in the way that it happened, it is also true to deny the very possibility that miracles occur is to deny the very core of the Bible itself, that the omnipotent creator redeemer God, distinct from creation, is continually active in sustaining the universe and is the proper object of obedient worship. It is therefore quite reasonable to expect such a God to interact with and intervene in his creation for the purpose to bring about shalom. Okay, with that definition in hand, I can now apply what I have been saying. And what I want to do is to start with those miracles that undo creation. Now, there are quite a few miracles in the First Testament that do so. We can talk about the Red Sea or the sun stopping in Joshua 10, 12 to 14. But I think that the more important set of miracles that undo creation are the signs and wonders in Egypt. Now, while I have already stated that it seems reasonable to assume that God can indeed intervene in creation, it's also to explain, if possible, how God intervenes. This is the more difficult question. If the example of Mara is indicative, it stands to reason that God intervenes in ways which don't always have to be direct, like a bolt out of the blue. Rather, it's more likely that God works in more hidden ways, as with a piece of wood in some water, or in the case of Tobit, with some fish gall applied to the eyes. Of course, in tackling such a text, like the signs and wonders in Egypt, we must also address the thorny issue of historicity of the Exodus itself. Since if such a text played such a fundamental role in shaping both the story and the collective conscience, the Volksgeist of Israel, it is simply unreasonable to assume that it has no historical basis. And yet when you try to actually do so, when you try to put the evidence, biblical evidence together with the historical and the archaeological evidence, it's like trying to square a circle. The reason is that these texts have been so heavily redacted, it's very difficult to separate the real historical core from later theological embellishment. Nonetheless, most scholars agree that the trend of migrant settlements in the Delta region in Egypt from Canaan is abundantly verified in extra-biblical sources. Of course, many of these same sources, the same scholars, would also agree that the Exodus could not have occurred during the time of Ramses II, 1279 to 1213 BCE, since Egypt at that time was at the peak of its authority. Others, based on correlating biblical data with Assyrian and Egyptian sources, place the Exodus around 1440 BCE. And yet, Dozman says that that can't work because this would equate the Exodus with the Amorite migration, but even the Bible says that, that's not possible. And so, what's a better way, or what is the best way of trying to understand when the Exodus happened? I think Trivisanto, Wittgenstein, and Silberman are correct in placing the time of the Exodus at the time of the fall of the Hyksos, the foreign kings of Egypt of the 15th dynasty, somewhere around 1670 to 1560 BCE. And at this time, there was a considerable and violent return of migrants from Egypt into Canaan. What's interesting about this theory is that, according to Trivisanto, it corresponds to a catastrophic volcanic eruption that occurred between the years 602 and 1600 and 1602 and 1600 BCE on the Greek island of Santorini that could have provided the ash unleashed the plagues in Egypt. On the screen, you have two images. One is a map of ancient the Mediterranean Sea, in which shows that the two red boxes show the distance between the islands, the Greek islands where Santorini would be, and with the delta region of the Nile. There's around 800 kilometers distance, and it's not unfathomable that the wind currents would have brought the plumes and the ash from Santorini all the way down to the Nile. The actual volcano was a catastrophic event, so much so that, as the second image shows, that the island of Santorini was completely fragmented. And in fact, that hole in the middle is where the volcano was. And this is a watershed moment in history in which even it gives rise to the Mycenaeans over the Minoans, right? And so it was a huge moment in history. What I like about Trevisanto is that he does provide compelling archaeological and scientific evidence which could account for what we find in the biblical narrative. And while he presents many pieces of evidence, what I think is more interesting is what we find on the screen, is that how Trevisanto amalgamates different scientific evidence. For instance, by the study done by Zelinsky and Alia concerning the sulfate content of the slices of ice cores from Greenland, and radiocarbon data with the historical, archaeological, and biblical evidence of the Exodus. Although, of course, it's not definitive, it is of note that between 1602 and 1600 BCE, there was both high sulfate content, 58 to 40 parts per billion, and very strong carbon-14 data, coinciding with the historical, archaeological, and biblical data during precisely this time of the fall of the Hyksos. So, if this was the case, how would a volcanic eruption cause what we see in the Bible? To begin with, the Nile turning red could cause it to be impregnated with volcanic materials. Such a situation, in combination to the presence of volcanic plumes and particles in the air, could have started a chain reaction. For instance, the volcanic material in the Nile could have caused the frogs, the second sign, to leave the Nile and enter into human habitations only to die. With all of the dead fish and frogs, the gnats and flies, the third and fourth sign, would have easily multiplied and caused havoc on both cattle and other animals, the fifth sign, as well as caused skin diseases, the sixth sign, in people. Due to volcanic dust in the air, the seventh sign of hail could be a form of acidic rain, and presented the right conditions for locusts, the eighth sign, to be abnormally prolific and aggressive, and could have also caused the ninth sign of darkness to cover the land. The last sign, the death of the firstborn, is more problematic because it presents itself as a sign that affects a very specific group, the firstborn among animals and humans. This sign, I think, if one were to look at the biblical text, one finds that the first nine signs are done in a very poetic structure that one can see them together. And the 10th sign is found outside of this poetic structure, which seems to indicate that it was on its own, that something different happened. And I do agree with those authors that the 10th sign seems to be this contrast between sacrifices. And in fact, it's no coincidence that the Passover is precisely sandwiched in between the beginning in which the 10th sign is introduced with the actual occurrence of the 10th sign later on. And in fact, this way, this 10th sign is a contrast of sacrifices in which Israel does the Passover and the Egyptians sacrifice their firstborn children and animals to their gods in vain. Now, this theory, of course, is not without its problems. For instance, a lot of scholars put the date of the eruption of Santorini in around the years 1670 to 1620 BCE. This would be too early. Trevisanto, in his book, does provide evidence to support his theory that it happened precisely during the fall of the Hyksos. However, I do think that more studies should be done in order to replicate what Trevisanto finds. And of course, biblical scholars cannot agree on when the actual date of the Exodus happened. Nonetheless, what's important for me is that this theory kind of shows how God works in creation, right? How do miracles work? Because it illustrates how God intervenes in creation. Just as when Moses threw a piece of wood into the bitter water to make it sweet, the people of God would have seen in this volcanic eruption the work of their God, and given such an intervention, a religious and theological interpretation. Of course, one could claim that the relation between a volcanic eruption and Israel attributing it to the work of God is what we call the God of the gaps argument, in the sense that the relationship is not one of divine agent who causes an effect, but one of coincidence. I see a volcano erupting and I say, ah, this is God, right? And yet I think that Moreland has a point when he states that God does not act as a primary causal agent who creates a gap in the natural fabric by acting in a way other than normal, regular activity. Just as we saw in Exodus 15, where a piece of wood was used to change bitter water sweet, God works in and through the natural causal fabric of creation. In other terms, miracles generally do not drop out of the sky like meteors, but rather happen through a God who prefers to use natural processes mediately as secondary causes to accomplish his purpose in the world. This purpose, or telos, would then be neatly encapsulated in the theological interpretation given to the event, wherein God calls the people back to him. In the cycle of signs and wonders, for instance, it could be said to be instigated, as we saw, with the measures that Pharaoh placed upon Israel in Exodus 1, which are fundamentally against life and creation. In order to demonstrate the folly of such a stance, God intervenes immediately through perhaps a volcanic eruption by means of 10 plagues that are directly related to the gods of Egypt. By defeating them, God demonstrates that he alone was worthy of worship. One example is the ninth sign, right? Which is the sign of darkness. This sign is certainly an affront to the sun god Ra. And since Ra was impotent in front of God, it is clear that the God of Israel is the stronger one. In all of this, I think I can summarize this section in 3 points. Firstly, by examining the complex relation between historical events and biblical narrative, I hopefully have illustrated that the real impetus of miracles is concerned with human flourishing and the life of shalom. Secondly, I have also briefly explained how God often intervenes in creation, not from outside of creation, but rather immediately through and in creation. Thirdly, upon possibly seeing the effects of the volcanic eruption, the people of God theologically interpreted the signs and wonders in Egypt as an undoing of the creation order, which does not simply serve to emphasize God's enduring sovereignty, but it is also a pedagogical tool to call humanity back to himself. Okay. Now that I hopefully have explained those miracles which undo creation, I want to turn my attention to miracles that restore creation. Now, it stands to reason if those miracles that undo creation are pedagogical tools to call humanity back to God, it would be more so with those miracles that restore creation. And while there are many miracles in the Old Testament, like particularly the miracles of the healing miracles of Elisha and Elijah, I think it would be better to turn my attention to the miracles of Jesus. Now, we concur with Rodea's claim that the majority of scholars studying the historical Jesus agree that Jesus performed miracles. Indeed, turning back to Meyer, I think Meyer is right to point out that with the criteria of multiple attestation of both sources and forms, from both biblical and extra-biblical, for example, Josephus, fonts, as well as the criteria of coherence, there's so much happening that it is virtually impossible that such actions of Jesus could be entirely made up by the early church. Now, for the most part, outside of those theophanic episodes, like the Transfiguration, the Incarnation, and even the Resurrection, I think that the miracles of Jesus can be formed critically divided into 2 main categories: nature miracles and healings and exorcisms. Nature miracles are so called because they generally concern surprising changes in the natural environment, such as the calming of the storm or the multiplication of bread and fish. Healings and exorcisms, for their part, involve those miracles that concern the sick being restored, as in the case of restoring the sight to the blind, or demons being cast out of people, as in the episode of the demonic in the synagogue at Capernaum. Since nature miracles of Jesus function in a similar way to the signs and wonders in Egypt and the episode at Mara, it makes little sense to belabor the point. And so I'm going to turn to the second group and particularly highlight the exorcisms of Jesus. And I think that the exorcisms of Jesus are the more important set because almost every account of healing is portrayed as an encounter with diabolical forces, wherein Jesus has come to release humanity from the binding powers of Satan. And again, many biblical scholars say that exorcisms are not possible, right? But however, to question the idea that Jesus cast out demons, I think it's to question a core value of the Gospels themselves, in particular the Synoptic Gospels. Because in the Synoptic Gospels, there is a basic claim that Jesus has come to repeal the kingdom of Satan and inaugurate the kingdom of God. And one can see this in particularly the Beelzebul controversy. And I think the Beelzebul controversy is the most paradigmatic episode in order to explain what Jesus is doing. And so to question that, I think, is to question the gospel itself. But furthermore, we can say that because of the criteria of multiple attestation of both sources and forms, even the criteria of modern embarrassment, and also the criteria of discontinuity with the Old Testament, I can follow the lead of Meyer and concur that it is fairly certain to state that Jesus was, among other things, a first century Jewish exorcist. But more to the point, in the New Testament, there is a relationship, a network of ideas between sickness, evil, and sin, and there is a language that invokes being imprisoned and bound by Satan, while the healing ministry of Jesus is often understood as a breaking of these chains. Satan then is understood as the one who captures humanity and placed it under bondage. He is the slave driver who, in keeping humanity bound in chains, subverts God's plans. Like Pharaoh in the First Testament, Satan in the Second Testament is considered as an arrogant and relentless tyrant, keeping the people away from the true Lord. Therefore, what Jesus does in the Second Testament is on the same level as what God does in the first, freeing the people from bondage under a tyrant and making possible the liberating life, a shalomic rest. I think a good example of this holistic and shalomic healing is the example of the Gerasene demonic. Indeed, the man enthralled by legion is found in Luke 8:27, naked, which of the culture of the time was indicative of shame and a lack of dignity. But he wasn't only naked. He was also living among the tombs and was bound by chains and shackles, illustrating that he was thought to be effectively cut off from both God and community. Even the name itself, legion, is telling. The presence of multiple entities inside of the man is certainly suggestive of unwholeness and is indicative of his being bound and shackled by Satan. After the miracle, the situation couldn't be any more different, right? He is rather than being a legion, he is back now to his old self. He is fully clothed and backed in his own mind. He is unshackled and no longer confined to the tombs, and he can once again be reintegrated into society. Jesus has made him whole, giving back his humanity, which he thought was lost. What a text explains, I think, is that this is an extraordinary act which comes about from a special act of Jesus in favor of restoring relationships, and that we can conclude that the miracles of Jesus are primarily a battle with the demonic and concomitantly an expression of the realization of the kingdom of God in the face of the defeat of Satan. In practicing a ministry of release against the binding powers of Satan, Jesus brings about physical healing, but also, and more importantly, wholeness and freedom from both diabolical and social restrictions. Okay, so as one can perhaps surmise, what I've said, what I've just explained, is the theological meanings of restoration, right? I've used the miracles of Jesus to explain such miracles because it allows me to fully discuss their purpose within the larger narrative of the Bible, but it also allows me to explain agency in a much more simpler way, right? Because while Jesus can use things like saliva or mud in his healing ministry, it's clear that the agent of these miracles is clearly Jesus himself. And yet, even if we assume that Jesus performs nature miracles, heals the sick, or casts out demons, we are still faced with a big problem that I must now try to address. How can I ever be certain that I'm correctly perceiving and identifying such an action as a miracle? Right? This is a problem, even in the New Testament, this is a problem that the Pharisees had, that the crowds have, right? And so this is exactly the question that I must now try to address. The biblical answer to such a question revolves around the heart, the central spiritual organ of man. Indeed, in both ancient Jewish and Hellenistic philosophy, the heart was thought to govern the intellectual, emotive, and volitive functions of a person. This was particularly dominant among the Stoics, who thought that the ruling part, identified with the heart, governs all the other parts of the soul, in which grows out of the ruling part and extends to the body just like a tentacle from an octopus, right? This is particularly from Aetius in his fragment that we have from the Stoics, right? And the idea is that the heart is like the head of an octopus, and all the tentacles move out to the eye, to the nose, to the ear, right? What would this imply for sight, for instance, is that while the eye is the instrument through which a person experiences the world, the heart would not only guide what the eye would see, but it would also interpret everything seen by the eye. Although the gate is what we call the eye is the gate to the heart, it is the heart that what decides what the eye sees and how it sees. Therefore, since perception concerns the eyes of the heart, Ephesians 1:18, one has to have the right kind of heart to see correctly. In the Bible, this right kind of heart is none other than the simple heart. A heart that, in being wholeheartedly focused on the Creator Redeemer God, appreciates its creatureliness and its complete dependency on God. In fact, the simple heart is possessed by Hoaplus, the simple one, who, in being completely focused on God, is also able to focus his or her eye on God alone. Of course, it's not easy. Right? It's very difficult to have this simple eye. And in fact, this was the main difficulty of Pharaoh, whose hard and blind heart conduced him to remain obstinate and reject any call to encounter with God. It's no coincidence that the signs and wonders in Egypt only happen after Exodus 5:1-2, in which Pharaoh rejects the call of Moses to let the people go to make a 3-day journey to worship the God of Israel by stating, "Who is the Lord? I do not know the Lord, and therefore I will not let your people go." Likewise, in the New Testament, those who were asking Jesus for a sign from heaven, particularly in Luke 11:14-16, failed to see what was happening right in front of them, that Jesus casting out a demon is the very sign they were waiting for. And this effectively signals that they have quote-unquote, an evil eye. Many biblical authors perhaps understood that such an endeavor required a long and demanding process through which one can predispose oneself to appreciating God's actions in the world. The starting point, as always, is to observe the created world and appreciate all the grooves that God has built into the world order. Indeed, although the natural revelation of God is imperfect, every human being has the capacity to appreciate the handiwork of the Creator, since God's invisible qualities, his power and divine nature, are revealed in creation. This appreciation of the Creator should then hopefully then ignite a chain reaction, which would allow an individual to appreciate that these grooves of creation do not only concern the general order of things, but how that individual would fit among the cogs of God's good design. Such a person would be hopefully motivated to know the Creator more and perhaps even enter into a covenantal friendship with him. This paideia then relates to the education of individuals' intellectual, emotional, and perception that would lead not only to an enlightening of the heart, but also make a greater capacity to see God's work within and through creation. If this is the case, it makes sense that many miracles would be mediated in and through creation, since the scope of such miracles would be to enlighten the eyes of the heart through a divine pedagogy that would hopefully lead to a deepening, healing, or establishing of a relationship with the Creator Redeemer God, resulting in shalom and human flourishing. Okay, conclusion. This essay has attempted to unravel the puzzle of biblical miracles by examining what is a biblical miracle and some of the more significant examples, all the while being attentive to issues of agency and perception. Of course, this essay is not pretended to be exhaustive. Many miracles, like the theophanies of Sinai or the transfiguration of Jesus, have not been discussed. Likewise, we did not tackle such problematic cases, such as the miracle of the sun in Joshua or the fish in the coin's mouth in Matthew. However, much more needs to be done on understanding perception and agency. But what did I hope that this essay or this presentation has done? This essay has attempted to provide a sort of guide to aid further examination on the topic at hand. It is evident that biblical miracles need to be examined from within the literary context and discussed on a case-by-case basis, and proceeded with an analysis of the larger context that miracles are found in. Since meaning is context-based, analysis would need to take into consideration issues such as historicity and genre, the passage within the miracle is embedded, and the miracle itself. But most of all, this essay has attempted to clarify that miracles must be studied within the larger narrative of the history of salvation. And whatever we think of them, they have the purpose to bring about shalom and human flourishing. In the end, biblical miracles can be considered to be ways and means through which God draws us to himself, in the hope that we can become more open to covenantal friendship and to live the life we were created to live. May we allow ourselves to be captivated by the enigma that is biblical miracles, so as to remember our Creator and Redeemer, and to be drawn further into God's world, in the hope that we too can participate in the flourishing that comes from him and from him alone. Thank you.